Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel. And today's guest on our show for New Books Jewish Studies and New Books Eastern European Studies is Natalia Aleksiun. She has a new book, and it's called Conscious History, Polish-Jewish Historians Before the Holocaust, published by Liverpool University Press and the Litman Library of Jewish Civilization, 2021. Welcome, Natalia, and thanks for joining us on the podcast here at New Books Network today.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you for having me.
So we're going to get started right away after I introduce Natalia's bio. Natalia Aleksiun is professor of modern Jewish history at the Graduate School of Jewish Studies, Touro College, New York. She published Where To? The Zionist Movement in Poland, 1944 to 1950, and co-edited two volumes of Poland, examining Holocaust memory and Jewish historiography. She has recently published a critical edition of The Destruction of the Żółkiew Jews by Gershon Taffet. And this book, Conscious History, is out 2021, as I mentioned. She's also preparing a volume of Poland devoted to Jewish childhoods, children, and child rearing in Eastern Europe. Natalia is completing two books, and we'll talk about this toward the end, on Jewish medical students in East Central Europe and also on daily life in hiding in Eastern Galicia. She is the co-editor-in-chief of a great journal that I read a lot, East European Jewish Affairs. So let's start with your motivation, Natalia. This is a monumental book, and there's so much in it. What motivated you to write it? Was this your doctoral dissertation?
This, yes, indeed, it was my doctoral dissertation, and it actually started with a seminar that I took at NYU many years ago. But this was encountering history of historiography and thinking about history writing as an exciting, interesting lens into social and intellectual Jewish history. And I read, I remember for that seminar, I read David Meyer's Reinventing the Jewish Past, European Jewish Intellectuals and the Zionist Return to History. And I thought over coffee, what would happen if that kind of thinking about historical writing and historical biographies was applied to Eastern European Jewish historians, and more specifically, to Polish Jewish historians? So this is how the project started. And only years into it, I actually started realizing that while it was an intellectual curiosity and a challenge, that was also something that had an autobiographical aspect to it, all connections that I only put into the frame later on, because I was my first institution where I was trained was University of Warsaw. I studied at the Institute of History, where, in fact, my heroes, many of the protagonists in my book, had studied in the 1920s and 1930s. So only later did I realize that, you know, we were sitting at the same tables in the historical library, and likely going to the same rooms in the old building of the Warsaw University Library. But it started with somebody else's great, exciting, insightful book.
Mm-hmm. And so for our listeners, what in your mind, in your opinion, is the Polish Jewish intelligentsia? How do you conceive of it? What are its origins? When was it formed?
No, this is a great question. So it, in a way, when we look at Polish Jewish intelligentsia in its early generation, when it emerges, it's at the same time closely connected or tied into the emergence of non-Jewish general Polish intelligentsia. It's the second half of the 19th century and the processes of urbanization and industrialization and modernization, and the increasing access to universities, although for Jews in some parts of partitioned Poland, and this is an important political context, both for the emergence of Polish intelligentsia and for the emergence of Polish Jewish intelligentsia, is that it's happening in the context of a vacuum in terms of a state, independent state. But it's a generation of men who are encountering new professional opportunities, but also closely connected. And I think that in that sense, it shares a certain mentalité with Russian intelligentsia. There is also a great sense of mission, of a need to not just have a career connected to a certain status and an education, but also to change the society, to improve the society, to speak to the people, as it were. And so Polish Jewish intelligentsia, to a large extent, seeks ways, and this is not just one way, but it begins participating in a variety of conversations. Some of them are closely connected to Jewish community. It's speaking to the Jewish community, about Jewish community, but it is also connected to broader Polish, Eastern European, and universal conversations about progress and education and rights and the role of the state. And historians are a part of it. So in fact, much has been written about some parts of Polish Jewish intelligentsia, lawyers, physicians, but historians are a strange creature because they are mostly in the 19th century, second half of 19th century, they're actually trained as lawyers. And they do history as a side to their other professions. And so the book, and I know we'll talk about it later, but the book is particularly interested in the time and place where doing history becomes, in a way, a full-time intellectual job, as it were, and mission at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that really is another question for me about the development of the profession. So my next question for you is about a kind of canon, or I don't know if I would describe it as a canon exactly, but initially in the world of Polish Enlightenment projects and this very multifaceted Romantic nationalism, there were a number of non-Jewish Polish historians who called for interest, right, in the so-called Jewish question, or Kwestia Żydowska, as it may have been called. Were you drawn to any specific historians, Polish Jewish or Polish non-Jewish historians, toward the end of the 18th century and early 19th century? And why, you know, why were you drawn to them, I guess, is my question.
I was. What I found interesting in that initial emerging discussion and the production of knowledge was, in fact, what you had just mentioned, that it was a subject that was considered extremely contemporary and important for Poland's future, and in that sense, for the Polish question, as the conversation was happening in the last years of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and throughout the partitions years, but that in that conversations, both emerging Polish and Polish-Jewish intelligentsia participated. And in some ways, what I found surprising, I think, is that in some of the writings of the Polish non-Jewish authors, the anti-Semitic tropes are not very veiled. You know, the conversation about Jewish domination, the conversation about excess of autonomy that Jews had experienced, this whole trope of Polish hospitality that allegedly turned against Poland because Jews kind of extended and expanded beyond what really was right. But at the same time, I guess for the lack of historical writing, these writings were a point of reference for Jewish historians, both at the time and later. They were not really treated as problematic expressions of bias. They were, of course, criticized, but in a way, this was a conversation in which both Jewish and non-Jewish Poles, as it were, participated, and even those Jewish historians that represented in a way a second path of Jewish intelligentsia, not necessarily acculturated men of letters, but traditional Jews, often with traditional education and autodidacts in other ways. They were also referring to these Polish non-Jewish authors. So this kind of shared conversation about the past with all the flaws and all the shortcomings, I thought that was interesting for the emerging body of literature, but also tropes and questions.
Yeah, I like that answer, because I think often in the framing of privileges, legal rights, there's almost an obsession sometimes in multi-volume histories about the excess, so-called excess of influence. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. I would actually like if you might introduce our listeners to some of the monumental history writers. You have Krauschar, for example, Historia Żydów w Polsce, Gumplowicz, I guess, you know, Chatzki. Who are these historians for those of our listeners who may not have, you know, spent time reading all of their volumes, because they're huge.
Well, I hope they catch up on this over the weekend.
Exactly. We need to go to the university library.
They will likely be dusted volumes. I think that Chatzki in some ways maybe stands for a lot of interesting aspects of this literature, because he publishes his treatise on a Jewish question on Jews actually and Karaites in the first decade of the 19th century, and this is very much still in the context of May 3rd 1791 constitution, the failed attempt of reforming the state ahead of the second and third partition. And so he, in a way, bridges between the Commonwealth, nobility, who takes interest in the questions that they see as connected for the well-being of the country as the country disappears from the map of Europe. And I know the map is a very important word for you. And so the way that Chatzki frames his treaty, precisely touching on some of these moments that you and I mentioned, which is Jewish autonomy, recognizing or stressing that Jews in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth enjoyed this a unique level of autonomy that they had played an important role in the economy of the state. And there is an element of implied criticism that, certain aspects of this relationship between the state and the Jews and non-Jewish neighbors, for lack of a better word, since it's not yet really fully a civic discourse, but that Jews and non-Jews, Gentiles living together, that some elements of this relationship need to be changed so that the country can do better in terms of administration and finances and taxation. But he frames again this interest that is both looking at the Jewish past through the Polish lens, as it were, what's good for the Polish state, what is the role of this population that is ultimately seen as foreign. He does stress that Jews have lived in Poland, in Polish lands for hundreds of years, but they are the guests that were received. But there is also, because of the interest in the Jewish autonomy, at least an opening, I think, to take interest in internal Jewish life. He doesn't do it. This is not part of the treaties. This is not why he sets out to write it. It's really a piece of work that is supposed to help statesmen in designing the best way of reforming state institutions. But he makes a gesture at the interesting curiosity about Jewish, internal Jewish institutions. And so I found this little book, it's not a big read, it's really short, it's a booklet, very fascinating how much, to what extent his mode of thinking had this long shadow and influence that had far exceeded the political context in which he was writing. Now, In all this 19th century writing, I think I was also quite interested in Alexander Krauthaar, whom you mentioned, and he takes on interest in Polish Gentile relations, Jewish Gentile relations, in legal status. But he is far more invested in going beyond the prescriptive ideas for how things, knowing history, should be used in designing the better future. Right. It's much more, I think, looking at the past for past's sake, although there is, of course, a sense that history is always in the service of, in some ways, bringing understanding, making the conversation between people living together on the same same soil, as it were. It's often repeated in this literature how they could and should know one another better. But it's more autonomous in a way way of historicizing.
That's Natalia, I'm really interested in how you describe in the 19th century, especially in the last decades, the development of schools of thought and the inclusion of research, you know, in Hebrew and Yiddish, especially the interpretation and incorporation of documents. I wonder if you might describe for us the development of schools of thought. I wonder if that's a fair term, but, you know, not just like at Jagiellonian University or in Warsaw, but there's people like Ashkenazi who mentor and shepherd, as you put it, almost an entire generation of Polish or Polonized Jewish intelligentsia. How do you see that landscape of academic professional history, professional Polish Jewish history developing? Is it one person? Is it a group of people? Is it a communal project where people are gathering the sources? How do you understand?
I would say, thank you. This is a great question, actually. I would say all of the above, but also you mentioning Ashkenazi or Ashkenazi, Shimon Ashkenazi, it allows me to make a geographic remark in placing this... the story of writing, but it's happening in a very concrete space of borders that are a result of partitions. And while Krauschar and Chatsky and Smolensky and others that we didn't mention earlier are all scholars writing in Warsaw, and in fact, this is the time when the first attempt at local history of Jewish community in Warsaw is made. But Ashkenazi makes quite physically, quite literally, a journey from Congress Poland to Galicia, to Lviv today, Lemberg, at the time, from the point of view of the from Vienna. And I think that this is an important aspect of this tale, which is that the schools, to some extent, are related to the place of intelligentsia in the context of various partitions. And so right. There is a particular way of writing Polish history and Polish Jewish history in Warsaw, which is to some extent conditioned by the Imperial Russian project and is in conversation, or rather an attempt to create a voice vis-a-vis the Imperial Russian project. And then the story in Galicia has a very different conditioning, let alone the fact that from the second half of 19th century, the universities, the Jagiellonian University that you mentioned and the University in Lviv are Polonized, something that is not quite the reality for aspiring intelligentsia in Congress Poland. So when Ashkenazi moves from Congress Poland to Lviv, he creates or contributes or becomes a backbone of a school that in a way... is centered on the Polish, patriotic Polish discourse, romantic Polish discourse, and he is very much the historian of the 19th century. And I must say, as someone who grew up reading historical books in Poland, he was such an amazing writer of the 19th century romantic Polish history that I think that his books still have the power to inspire his biography of Prince Poniatowski. So in a way, there is a geographic component. And then there is, of course, the component of the audience. There is a component of positioning of Polish Jewish and Polish historiographies in relationship to one another. And what is unique, I think, for Galicia, especially at the turn of the end of 19th century, towards the end of 19th century, is that there is a number of Polish scholars, Polish-Polish scholars, who are supportive of the development of Polish Jewish historiography with an understanding that this is something that Polish historiography needs. And that is different from, let's say, what I mentioned earlier, people like Aleksander Maciejowski and Czacki himself. These Polish historians are not themselves interested in writing about the past of Polish Jews, but they want that history to be written. And they want that history to be written by scholars who can access Jewish sources.
Exactly.
And you mentioned sources, I think, in one of the previous comments. What do you need to read to reconstruct the past? And while we might have many answers to this question now, but methodological ideas about it are quite well formulated. We're talking about a time when it's all very fluid. So the fact that leading Polish historians at the Jagiellonian University, at the Lwów University, people who are heads of major archives are encouraging young Jews coming into university to study history, to take on Jewish topics, as part of Polish historiography. I think that also marks a very important change in the status of that conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to ask that too, because I'm really fascinated in the middle of your book by this idea of a mainstream. And I guess I would, Becoming Polish Mainstream is the title of one of your chapters, and it might be my favorite chapter.
Mine too.
Because I feel like there's this major shift that happens with the formation of the Second Polish Republic. I wonder if you could talk about that. I think maybe, they are men, mostly, maybe even all men, but they have very interesting careers, which are somewhat traditional. I mean, some of them are still, involved, I guess, in the places from which they come, even when they leave Lwów or leave Galicia. So, like, how is a mainstream formed once there is a Polish state? And I guess these are university-trained historians, ultimately, who go full-fledged into the profession. But what are their lives?
Precisely. There are two key aspects to it, and you nailed both of them. So I will just elaborate on what you already identified. One is that they're moving away from Galicia, and unlike Ashkenazi who came to Lwów to teach, and then left it when the Second Polish Republic emerged from the First World War. This generation of men, and yes, they were all men, Meyer Bauaban, Moses, Mojżesz Szor, and Ignacy Itzhak Schieper, the three pioneering professional historians, again, unlike this earlier generation, they were not autodidacts and not autodidacts as historians. And their credential was university diplomas of Lwów, of Vienna, and of Jagiellonian University. And that is what makes them more mainstream. So in a way, going back for just a second to my previous answer, this mainstreaming starts before 1918 with encouraging the subfield of historiography, with welcoming these men into the archives, writing for them, all we know as part of the academic universe, recommending them to people who might share documents with them or access to material, et cetera, et cetera. But the mainstreaming of Jewish, Polish-Jewish historical writing becomes really possible in the Second Polish Republic. And this is again connected to a university as an essential institution that grants the recognition for the field. And that is connected with several people, especially with Marceli Handelsmann, a fascinating figure of a very patriotic Polish Jewish intellectual who thought of himself primarily as a Pole, who was instrumental in building Warsaw University during the German occupation from 1915 on, and who had a very bold vision of bringing to this new Department of Humanities a variety of historians to build Warsaw University. Now this is a capital, right? This is not right, just right. A town in the somewhere on the outskirts of the empire, but building this essential site for training Polish historians. And so he encourages people to study all kinds of histories, among these history of Polish Jews. So one of the people that were very closely connected with him and of whom I'm sure all of our listeners would know is Emanuel Ringelblum, the future organizer of Onek Shabbat of Warsaw Ghetto Archive. And then Handelsmann does an even bolder thing, which is to invite
That's my next question. Who and why get invited?
So he invites, and I think that it's fascinating that it's not just Jewish history. He invites Meyer Bauerbahn in 1927 to teach. This is a state university. It doesn't have the system of chairs, but Bauerbahn is specifically brought to teach Jewish history, and he does teach Polish Jewish history for the most part. But Handelsmann invites also Miron Korduba to teach Ukrainian history. Mm-hmm. So this is in a way this inclusive vision of the Polish past, which is not just the past of ethnic Poles, not just a past of Catholic Poles, but it's a past of all kinds of inhabitants of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and then partitioned Polish lands. And so Bauerbahn finds himself in Warsaw first to teach at the newly formed high school for traditional Jews who pursue traditional education and train as rabbi, but they also receive secular training as part of it. And he's responsible for their secular training. And there are fascinating stories about the clashing of his worldview with more orthodox members of the faculty. Moises Szor, who during the First World War becomes more of a scholar of Semitic languages than a scholar of Polish Jewish history, comes to Warsaw to teach in the Department of Orientalist Studies. And Ignacy Itzhak Schieper comes to Warsaw as part of his political career. And this is this geographic, spatial, political aspect of the story. While Galicia was a welcoming site conversation about Jewish and Polish Jewish past, and Sam Kaso and Rachel Manekin wrote about it in their own work. Now in the new state, it is Warsaw that really offers the opportunity.
I guess I'm curious, you know, I know you've written about this elsewhere, Natalia, about professionalization and the extent to which it's inclusive and open, and also, you know, how many women are taking part in this and being trained.
I so wanted to mention women.
Could you talk about Bauerbahn and, you know, his, like, remember the story of the Festschrift, but it's also the seminars that he had at the Institute of Jewish Studies at Warsaw University. You have this marvelous part about Clara Minksberg, I think was her name, and the oral interview. So, you know, tell us, are these institutes actually welcoming women's history and women's studies? What was life like in those seminars in Warsaw, but, you know, also YIVO and YIVO Institute in Vilna? Do you think that they were inclusive? And
were inclusive. I'm not entirely sure that they were consciously inclusive, going out of their way to encourage women. Just like you mentioned before, that generation in early 20th century Galicia are all men. And then when we look at the young historians that come to play a role in this mainstream 1920s and 1930s Second Polish Republic historical profession, roughly one third of Bauerbahn's students are women. These are women who receive an MA or a doctoral degree in history, writing on Jewish topics. What I know, in some ways, you know, the nature of researching the aspects of social life of Polish Jews before the Holocaust is limited by the kinds of documents that survived, especially the kinds of personal narratives.
I
would love to have come across, exchanges of letters of former students of Meyer Bauerbahn, but I was still able to find some traces in memoirs, in oral interviews, what you mentioned. So what I found fascinating about Bauerbahn was the way that he was consciously drawing students in and consciously making the connection between them and their personal biographies. And this was also working well for his understanding of building the field, something that he shared with other, with Shoren Schipper, also Philip Friedman, who plays an important role in as a pioneer of Holocaust scholarship, but comes out of this milieu as well, of Raphael Mahler, which is local histories. And so Bauerbahn has this way of, and there are several accounts of it, how in the first seminars, he would ask students where they come from and then tell stories about the history of Jewish community in these towns, and sometimes even pick names of the students and come up with anecdotes about famous Jews that bore the same last name. And I thought it was an interesting pedagogical tool to make them feel intimate in the context of the history of Polish Jewry. Now, I'm not entirely sure how the process, you know, I have the list of topics that his students wrote about, the Festschrift you mentioned that has this list, and I found student records, so I was able to some extent map out that new generation that, for the most part, was murdered in a Holocaust. Yeah. The new generation of scholars, but also teachers and journalists and pedagogues, and And so I wonder often to what extent Balaban likely assigned topics to his students. This is somewhat based on my own personal experience in the 1990s when students were not yet free to choose whatever they wanted to write about.
Right.
But I thought it was also very smart because if you were, in a case of, for example, Brody, there is a wonderful monograph on the history of Jews in Brody, written by David Wurm, who ended up being a teacher in a local gymnasium there after he graduated. You know, if you came from this town, you knew who had the chronicle of the community, who might have had some documents from the past, whom to ask to have these documents for two nights and copy. And much of this work, to some extent at least, preserved documents that that disappeared a few years later during the war. And so even if this was not spontaneous choice of his students, it seems or it reads when you put together the topics and the biographies to the extent, again, that we can reconstruct them from student files, this seems like an extremely personal list of, right, of entry into the field. And that goes both for male and female students. And there is one student that I have a particularly strong connection with, Sarah Eisenstein, who wrote with Balaban as her advisor, a dissertation about the history of Jewish and Polish women in the early modern period in the 17th and 18th century. And it's an extremely explicitly demanding change kind of a thesis. And again, it would be fascinating to know whether this was something that she came to her professor with, because the whole thesis is about how we need to explore the past of women more, and they cannot and should not be just dismissed, and the history is ultimately history of men, and how we need to look for sources, and it might be difficult because the sources are, for that period, are created by men. I mean, you read it, and it reads like a kind of manifesto that would be written in the early 90s. So it's fascinating.
That's interesting. Yeah.
It's fascinating to, I guess, just raise a question whether Balaban, you know, a man of that generation, might have been interested in this, or even initiated it, or was he simply willing to guide that kind of a topic? And in the manuscript, these theses and dissertations are partially typed, but most of them are handwritten, which I actually very much enjoyed working in the archives. I felt that this gave me some kind of intimate moment of encounter with the authors. And there are some comments with a red pencil that Balaban makes on the margins, but he doesn't seem to tone down the voice calling for a new kind of perspective on the history of Polish Jews.
And I guess, you know, I did want to ask you a question about the public aspect of this. And I mean, people have to read your book because there are so many journals and I guess even dailies that are covered, sometimes with subscriptions in the thousands or tens of thousands. I mean, how in the 1930s, especially like after the Piłsudski coup and so forth, is public outreach conceived? You mentioned Balaban and how important it was, you know, for professors at universities to get beyond the ivory tower, become involved in curricula and sort of even in rabbinical schools and things like that. So, I mean, what's the story in the 1930s with Polish Jewish historians? Do you feel or do you sense that the outreach that began with YIVO and the Institute of Jewish Studies was strong? I mean, was there a moment in time when the professionals who, you know, started in the Second Republic felt threatened, or somehow the state was interfering? I mean, how did that, you know, sort of professional world turn into a public world in the 1930s, before 1939?
Yeah, that is one of the key questions, I think, in that book. And the conversation, in a way, that I have with the work of other historians who worked on Polish Jewish culture in the 30s. And it's something that remains for me open. Now, whether this was this whole idea of and the sense of necessity of writing Polish Jewish history, was it, despite mainstreaming of it, despite being allowed into university, did it remain a counterculture of sorts? Sam Casso actually uses the term counter-profession, and right. Stressing the fact that they still remained marginalized. I take a little bit more of an inclusive view of it. I think that they truly were mainstreamed, and that some of the difficulties that Jewish graduates of Warsaw University, especially, but to some extent of the university in Vilno, back then Vilnius, today Stefan Batory University, had was in fact shared by non-Jewish students. Likely being Jewish didn't help with employment, but there was an access of intelligentsia, especially in humanities, especially in the context of the economic crisis in more general terms. But putting aside this question of whether being able to publish in some major Polish journals, a few of the historians being able to publish their books with grants coming from general Polish sources, where do we draw the line of making it, as it were?
Right.
They clearly also see themselves as public intellectuals. And again, this is something that I find extremely relevant for the professional, for our professional life as historians today. And the fact that these are minority historians, you know, what does it mean for minority historians to be public historians and to share the research with a variety of audiences, both Jewish and not Jewish? I don't want to say Polish, because Polish Republic is a multi, Second Polish Republic is a multi-ethnic state. It's not just Poles and Jews. It's Ukrainians, Belarusians, Lithuanians, Germans, Czechs. So there is a whole range of audiences. And I think that they have, aside from lack of positions at universities and limited chances of employment, they have a genuine interest in speaking to the broader public. And you mentioned rabbis. I look at in the book at military rabbis as one particular channel, one particular venue in preaching, as it were, a particular vision of Jewish past to Polish Jewish men who had been drafted into the Polish army. And looking at the text of the oath that the military rabbis prepare, looking at the kind of sermons that they're being given, but also sermons that rabbis give to school children that are brought to synagogues on Polish national holidays, and how all these are efforts to weave together Jewish past and Polish past. So, for example, Polish Jewish soldiers are the new Maccabees on the one hand, right?
That's an interesting analogy. I never thought of it that way. Yeah.
Well, it's explicitly stated in some of the texts, but at the same time, they follow, and maybe this is much more predictable. They follow the wonderful tradition of Berek Yoselevich, right? The beloved patriotic traditional Jew on a horse fighting in the Polish insurrections against Russia. I mean, what can be better? So they kind of position Polish Jews both in the context of broader Jewish past and then very specific Polish Jewish past. And that is repeated in textbooks, in speeches, in sermons, in articles published by dailies. Now, the question that I have is the extent to which this actually convinced people, you know, the extent to which it spoke to people, spoke to a Jewish audience. And I think it did. I think that what we see, well, during the Holocaust, if we look at the texts written by many Jews during the Holocaust, diaries, testimonies, they write about themselves as Polish Jews. And I think this is the product not only of education in Polish state schools, where the vast majority of Jewish children received their education, despite fascinating experimentation with Jewish schooling networks of various political stripes. But it is also the work of this public history happening over 20 years. And the other question is, to what extent this discourse of Jews belonging in Poland, being at home in Poland, not being guests for 800 years, contributing, to what extent it convinces Polish audience, Polish non-Jewish audience? Mm-hmm. And from
that's a great question. I guess, you know, can I ask if you might recommend works that people might read on this? I mean, I know you have Bartal, for instance, and Gershon Hundred, but what would you say, Natalia, that people could read in order to understand this tension of integrationism and assimilation?
Oh, this is fascinating. Well, the most recent book that I found just wonderfully complicating the story, and it takes place in Galicia. So in a way, it also explains, I think, to some extent, the uniqueness of that part of Polish Jewish heritage, is Rachel Manekin's The Rebellion of the Daughters. And
I don't know that.
It came out just now with Princeton University Press. The subtitle is Jewish Women Runaways in Habsburg Galicia. And what she shows, I think very compellingly, is how Polish education in primary schools, and in particular in gymnasia in the early 20th century, how it reshapes the generation of young Jewish women, and how they really become almost implicitly culturally integrated individuals, but also creating a tremendous tension against the gender line, because this is the kind of education that young women are allowed to, even from a very traditional families, but their brothers would not. I think that in a way, this is a part of the conversation about integration and the pull and the push and the attractiveness of Polish culture, but also the danger of it. The danger of it, in a sense, also that the integration is not really happening as an experience of many of these women and men. But by focusing on women, I think Rachel's book does put a very interesting new angle. And there is Agnieszka Jagodzińska is sort of on the other geographic end because she focuses on Warsaw, and she looks at the younger or older rather generation is the book of Agnieszka Jagodzińska In Between, that looks mm-hmm. at the kind of cultural changes happening in dress, in cultural interests among Warsaw, in particular Warsaw Jews. Mm-hmm. But highly recommended. And these, in a way, are sort of archaeology of the generation that my book focuses on, which are people that come of age and are already schooled in the post-World War I, Second Polish Republic.
Fabulous, Natalia. And really, you know, we've covered so much ground and I could talk to you for hours.
Likewise.
But we've got about a minute and a half. Could you tell us about your current project or projects?
Oh, with pleasure.
What you're working on? Z przyjemnością, please.
With pleasure. So I am working on two book manuscripts, and they are very different in a way. One was led into it by David Wurm, whom I mentioned, a student of Bałaban who was teaching in Brody and was shot in the summer of 1941, very shortly after the entrance of attack of Germany against the Soviet Union. But it looks at daily life in hiding in Eastern Galicia. Eastern Galicia, because it has a very particular ethnic makeup between Poles, Ukrainians, and Jews and Germans, of course, in very much shaping the story. Omer Bartov did a fantastic job looking at Buchac, but I'm focusing on the time when people are seeking hiding places and all of Eastern Galicia, especially actually in rural contexts, and seeing very interesting continuities or effects of neighborly relations during the before the war. So just give you one example, Jewish physicians who are often hidden by their very poor peasant patients, and the pattern seems to be peasants whose wives, likely in labor, were saved by Jewish doctors who did not take money for their service, and then these former patients feel tremendous sense of indebtedness. It's of course not a simple story, uplifting right. story of goodness and gratitude, but that's just one of the stories in which the relations before the war shape the strategies and the chances for survival. And then the second book is quite an adventure because it's a comparative study that looks at Poland, Romania, Austria, and Czechoslovakia, but more specifically Slovakia, and at the conflict over dissections in the interwar period when Christian students, or they describe themselves as such, or Romanian, Polish, Slovak students, demand that Jewish students should not be allowed to dissect non-Jewish medical bodies in the process of their training as physicians, and pressure Jewish communities to be forced to provide Jewish medical bodies for dissections as a condition for the training of Jewish students as future physicians.
My goodness. I will read that. let me know when you're finished.
It's quite remarkable. And if I have another minute, I will share how I came across it, because it's connected with my historians. So I was reading
15 seconds. Go.
Yes, I was reading a report on the situation at the university. On one page, there was the Dean of Humanities talking about what's going on. And on the other side of the same booklet was the Dean of Medical School saying, this semester was peaceful because we received a provision of Jewish brains from the hospital at Chiste. And so the cadaver affair was quite peaceful. And I thought to myself, cadaver affair? Jewish brains? And that's how the book started.
That's your teaser. That's your teaser for the book.
Absolutely.
Look, Natalia, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on New Books Network. I'm Steven Siegel. We've been speaking with Natalia Aleksiun about her new book. It's called Conscious History, Polish Jewish Historians Before the Holocaust, published by Liverpool University Press and the Litman Library of Jewish Civilization, 2021. Gratulacja. Thank you, Natalia,
for joining me.
And I'm your host here, Steven Siegel, on the New Books Network. Thanks for joining us. Until next time.